This is show 163, part 5 of the Mark Curtis's book Secret Affairs, British Collusion with Radical Islam. Chapter 8. This is gets into the 1970s and 80s. Training in Terrorism, the Afghan Jihad. Jihad, by the way, the word jihad, I looked it up years ago, is to strive. The true meaning is really about a personal striving in the way that anybody's spiritual path, the life, whatever, is the battle, you know, with themselves, really. Not out there fighting other people, but conquering your own stuff so that then you can get along better. And maybe in the Islamic way, there's some kind of... you know, there's two jihads. There's the personal, and then I think there's the sort of self-defense jihad type of thing. I'm not sure. It's been a while since I looked that one up. But I think that's where some of the extremists, and it got twisted into this, you know, crazed interpretation of jihad. So chapter 8 begins. The war against the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan in the 1980s was to mark the next phase in the development of global Islamic radicalism, building on the Islamic resurgence during the previous decade. Following the Soviet invasion of December 1979, tens of thousands of volunteers from around the Muslim world flocked to join their Afghan brethren and fight the communists. During the course of the war, they went on to form organized jihadist militant groups that would eventually target their home countries and the West in terrorist operations. These Mujahideen and the indigenous Afghan resistance groups to which they were attached were bolstered by billions of dollars in aid and military training provided mainly by Saudi Arabia, the U.S., and Pakistan, but also by Britain. As mentioned in the previous show, after 9/11, I think that as news history started coming out, this is perhaps the most well-known of the history. But as this book is showing, it goes farther back. Britain already had a long history of supporting and working alongside Islamist forces by the time the Soviets crossed the Afghan border, but the collusion with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan was of a different order to those earlier episodes, part of Whitehall's most extensive covert operation since the Second World War. The problem with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, as Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher put it after 6 months in office, was that if its hold on Afghanistan is consolidated, the Soviet Union will in effect have vastly extended its borders with Iran, will have acquired a border more than 1,000 miles long with Pakistan, and will have advanced to within 300 miles of the Straits of Hormuz, which control the Persian Gulf. In public, the Prime Minister and other British leaders denied British military involvement in Afghanistan and claimed to be seeking purely diplomatic solutions to the conflict. British aid to the Afghan resistance began to flow even before the Soviet invasion, while Whitehall authorized M16 to conduct operations in the first year of the Soviet occupation, coordinated by M16 officers in Islamabad in liaison with the CIA and Pakistan's intelligence service. Now, this got me looking up why the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, because some of it wondered, were the Soviets the bad guys for doing that? But it was kind of mixed. I forgot the exact reason, so you can look it up. It had something to do, you know, with protecting one's people or radical groups or communism or something like that. And here I have the gist of jihad psychology. Talking about various Muslim Brotherhood leading thinkers, name some names, party of the same name in Pakistan, Maududi, M-A-W-D-U-D-I, who had significant influence on generations of Islamists and jihadists, believed that modern civilization was leading the world to doom and that only Islam could rescue it. Here's a kind of, what's that word? apocalyptic reasoning, Armageddon reasoning for doing what they do. And a little farther on in the chapter, in July 1979, President Carter, concerned about the new regime's closeness to the Soviet Union, began sending covert aid to Islamist opponents of the regime, the third attempt by outside actors since 1975 to organize an uprising against the regime in Kabul. The operation was undertaken in liaison with Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and was part of a plan by an intergovernmental body established by Carter, the Nationalites Working Group, to promote unrest among the ethnic minorities in the Soviet Union, a strategy reminiscent of Britain's age-old policies in the region. The secret aid was dispatched 5 months before the Soviet invasion. Brzezinski, Carter's national security advisor, later said that he told Carter of his hope that the U.S. aid would induce a Soviet military intervention that would fail and therefore give the USSR its Vietnam War. Nice guy, huh? Anyway, Carter's still my, quote, favorite president, end quote, but, you know, he's got some mixed bag history, too. Farther on, here I have a note, the changing of the empires. Britain also appears to have begun to secretly support the Afghan rebels before the Soviet invasion. December 17, 1979, a special coordination meeting was held in the White House, chaired by Carter's vice president, Mondale, involving all key U.S. government departments. As Soviet troops were amassing near the Afghanistan border, threatening to invade to shore up the communist regime, the meeting agreed to explore with the Pakistanis and British the possibility of improving the financing, arming, and communications of the rebel forces to make it as extensive as possible for the Soviets to continue their efforts. Thus, the British now began to play what had become their primary role vis-a-vis the Americans, that of junior partner in U.S.-led covert action, a sharp contrast to the more equal role enjoyed by London in the 50s. Britain would carry out specialist tasks such as training the Afghan resistance and dispatching covert operations to support the fighting. Overall, the U.S. plan was to cast the Soviets as opposing Muslim religious and nationalist expressions. Then we have Thatcher, who would championed Islam as an alternative to Marxism. talk about the, they have to double speak and read between the lines. Thatcher's giving a speech and she says, the Middle East is an area where we all have much at stake, aka oil and dollar bills. And again, the kind of geopolitical religious stuff. On a later visit to a refugee camp near the Afghan border, Thatcher told her audience that you left a godless country because you refused to live under a godless communist system, which is trying to destroy your religion, and that the hearts of the free world are with you. In the next section, organization of the jihad. There is no evidence of direct British or U.S. support to bin Laden, but one CIA source has claimed that U.S. emissaries met directly with bin Laden, and it was he who first suggested that the Mujahideen be supplied with Stinger anti-aircraft missiles. Then again, I mentioned Sadat's Egypt. This is post-Nasser. And after seizing power, Zia proceeded to project himself and Pakistan as the champion of Islam, and narrow and bigoted religiosity became Pakistan's state policy. A lot of these things seem like a reaction to something else. And here's a bit where I read about this over and over and over again in the news in the past bunch of years, where weapons get shipped somewhere, and then, you know, you have the risk of what happens to them. Of the huge quantities of arms exported to Pakistan for supposed onward distribution to the Afghan groups, around a third were sold onto the black market by Pakistani forces, never reaching the intended recipients. From 1983 to 87, the annual shipment of weaponry rose from 10,000 to 65,000 tons. The Afghan resistance was organized into seven main groups known as the Peshawar Seven, after a city in northwestern Pakistan. One historian has called them the four most important groups were all hardline and militant, professing holy war and committed to building an Islamic society. One historian has called them the Ikhwahabis, influenced both by the ideology of the Muslim Brothers, Ikhwanism, IKHWAN, and by the ultra-conservative ideology of the Saudis, Wahhabism. The Hezb-e-Islami was split into two factions. One was led by Hekmatyar, who had broken away from Rabbani's Jamaat-e-Islami and was dominated by Muslim Brothers. This was the most powerful of the Afghan factions and received the largest share of external aid, notably from the ISI and Pakistan's Jamaat-e-Islami. and on and on and on. And we get into, there's a section about Jizya and Musharraf. I think that's in Pakistan. According to some analysts, it was then that Musharraf came into contact with Osama bin Laden. Musharraf recently wrote in his autobiography that we helped create the Mujahideen, fired them with religious zeal in seminaries, armed them, paid them, fed them, and sent them to a jihad against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. He claims that neither Pakistan nor the U.S. realized what Osama bin Laden might later do with the organization that we all had enabled him to establish. U.S. instruction of the Pakistanis and senior Afghan commanders was in areas such as the use of explosives, automatic weapons, and remote-controlled devices for triggering mines and bombs, demolition, and arson, practices that would later be used in terrorist operations. The CIA provided a variety of arms to the ISI, including plastic explosives, sniper rifles, and sophisticated electronic timing and detonation devices that made it easier to set off explosions from a remote location. Dual-use items that could be used both for attacking military targets and also in terrorist operations. Britain also directly trained Afghan forces, much of which was contracted out to private security firms. And then he mentions M16, CIA bases in Saudi Arabia and Oman. Ken Connor, who served in the SAS for 23 years, says that he was part of a team of ex-SAS soldiers who trained selected junior commanders in the Mujahideen in Scotland and northern England in 1983. The Afghans were smuggled into Britain disguised as tourists and trained in three-week cycles at secret camps. They were well-armed and ferocious fighters, but they lacked battlefield organization. Connor notes that there was strong empathy between the British trainers and the Mujahideen, but that there was little warmth between the Mujahideen and the British government. It was strictly a marriage of convenience between two organizations that had nothing else in common. And eventually here in this chapter, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan get mentioned. Somebody, he also wrote that they were probably the most secret and sensitive operations of the war, and that the Soviet Union's specific worry was the spread of fundamentalism and its influence on Soviet Central Asian Muslims. Not sure which exactly operations, but propaganda operations were also conducted involving Afghan rebels distributing Korans in the Uzbek language, which had been printed by, wait for it, the CIA. M16 funded the leader of Pakistan's Jamaat-e-Islami, Qazi Hussein Ahmad, who had close links with Hekmatyar and Massoud, to pump money and Islamic literature into the Soviet republics of Tajikistan and Uzbekistan to incite the local religious circles to rebel against their communist governments. Hay gavolt. And the last page or so of this chapter, The Reckoning. After Soviet forces were expelled from Afghanistan in 1989 and the pro-Soviet government of Mohammad Najibullah was overthrown in 1992, Hekmatyar's forces fought Massoud's for control of Kabul in the ensuing civil war, killing thousands of civilians in the process. By 1996, the Taliban had driven Hekmatyar's forces out of Kabul and soon taken control of the country, forcing Hekmatyar into exile. By now, the secular leftist political forces in the country had been eliminated, and Afghanistan's immediate future would be decided only by the Islamist groups. More importantly, by the end of the Soviet occupation, the foreign Mujahideen veterans were forging a radical and violent utopianism that called for jihad as armed struggle. This was based on the ideology of the Saudi-sponsored Wahhabis and Abdullah Azam's call for martyrdom and the belief that Islam alone had defeated the Soviets. Thousands of previously untrained volunteers had received military instruction in often sophisticated techniques while gaining first-hand experiences of fighting. The Arab-Afghan volunteers, especially those from Egypt, Yemen, Indonesia, Algeria, and Libya, now saw their primary objective as returning to their homelands to struggle against their own governments, while bin Laden hoped to unite them as a global force. Bin Laden's Al-Qaeda organization was a direct product of the war set up in 1988 out of the networks that were developing between the Afghans and the foreign fighters. Tony Blair's Foreign Secretary Robin Cook would later say that the name Al-Qaeda, meaning the base, derived from the database, the computer file of the thousands of Mujahideen who were recruited and trained with help from the CIA, and he forgot to say M16. Several of the Afghan camp networks built at this time with CIA, ISI, or Saudi aid would subsequently be used by Al-Qaeda as bases for training and planning terrorist attacks, including Tora Bora, south of Jalalabad, which was constructed by one of Yunus Khali's commanders. Al-Qaeda would likely not have emerged to the extent that it did had it not been for the infrastructure of the Afghan resistance built with U.S. and British backing. Specific British contributions included specialized military training provided to various forces, covert military supplies, and support for the larger U.S. covert role in the war. Whitehall thus made a British contribution to the imminent emergence of global Islamist terrorism. However, it would be the emergence of new Pakistani forces from the Afghan Jihad that would be just as important to the future of global terrorism as the creation of Al-Qaeda, and these would eventually prove more dangerous to Britain. Well, that's that chapter, and as I was reading that, what came to mind was seeing it was post 9/11 when they were showing the Afghan the Al-Qaeda, supposedly the Al-Qaeda training grounds with these, you know, hairy looking scary dudes swinging off of what seemed like grade school jungle gyms. Maybe they had rifles and weapons and stuff like that, but I think that it was like the image they were trying to create was of these sort of crazed, savage, out in the woods off of civilization, you know, crazed rogue group. But then while reading that book, clearly, if you've been listening so far to the series, shows how, over a century, really, training, for lack of a better word, training, distribution of materials, a building of infrastructure and networks, and et cetera, et cetera. And not to say that that is all connected with terrorists. I'm not saying, from what it's saying of mosques being built. Now, I don't know what percentage, say, would be, real religion or whatever you want to call it. But basically, the groundwork and the framework for much of what we have come to know as this Islamic terrorist act, terrorist sects or whatever, is taking a while to build up. So I don't know what that means as far as how does it disassemble. I think about that a lot with the talk of the, with energy, sustainable energy and resources. And it's easy to say, we need to get off fossil fuel. And sure, I'm for that to some extent, it seems. I don't know how we could do without some of it. But when you look at the whole infrastructure in the country, in the U.S. and probably other parts of the world, that's a huge, huge thing. So it's not quite as simple as just yay sustainable. But hey, it starts the dialogue, and again, the shift of consciousness of people to a peaceful way is one way to sort of overnight shift training camps. And there's a lot of work in the future I see for transmuting energies and places and schools and battlefields where there has been, this putrid support of, extremism and violence. And anyway, so there's a lot of work today and for future generations. And chapter 9, the dictator, the king, and the Ayatollah. This gets into the 1980s. The 1980s were a decade in which the British elite under Margaret Thatcher sought to reassert British power around the world. A deepened special relationship with Washington involved Whitehall backing an extraordinary period of U.S. military intervention in the developing world under Ronald Reagan, elected in 1980. 1982 Falklands War ran alongside covert British operations to assist the U.S. wars in Nicaragua and Cambodia, where London provided secret military training to guerrilla forces allied to Pol Pot's genocidal Khmer Rouge. The Thatcher government allowed U.S. planes to use British territory to bomb Libya in 1986 and spoke out in lone support of the illegal U.S. invasion of Panama in 1989, carried out under Reagan's successor, George Bush Sr. Thatcher also strongly supported, indeed in many respects propelled, a massive Western rearmament program forcing an arms race with the Soviet Union and, for a time, a dangerous new period in international relations. The Soviet threat was constantly invoked by Thatcher and Reagan as lurking behind all malign influences in the world, but the reality was that independent regimes remained Washington and London's primary problems. The reassertion of Western power was to a large extent a belated response to the decolonization process that had taken off in the 1950s, challenging Western and specifically British power in Africa, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia. Reagan and Thatcher's strategy entailed nothing less than an economic reordering of the world involving a sweeping privatization of state corporations, deregulation of the financial sector, and liberalization of trade and investment policies. Dozens of developing countries were subject to this economic interventionism, usually under the formal auspices of structural adjustment programs managed by the essentially U.S.-controlled World Bank and International Monetary Fund. The primary beneficiaries were Western corporations seeking access to new markets, while poverty and levels of inequality shot up in many countries. No pun intended, I guess. This new interventionism also involved a market intensification of support for a number of radical Islamic forces. The massive covert program in Afghanistan to counter Soviet power enhanced the proficiency and militancy of the Mujahideen forces, who were forming themselves into battle-hardened organizations capable of global action. Thatcher and Reagan also deepened their special relationships with the two major state sponsors of radical Islam, Pakistan under General Zia, and Saudi Arabia under King Fahd, F-A-H-D. Whitehall also tried to enhance links with and arm Iran, now under Islamist rulers. These policies are invariably ignored in mainstream analysis of the Thatcher years. They show that British and American planners believed that their aims to reshape the global economy in the interest of Western business and counter nationalist or Soviet-backed forces could be achieved in alliance with the Islamist right, just as they had throughout the entire post-war period. So there again, the recurring theme of Western interests and sort of literally using the Islamist right, knowing the danger, and yet. And so, as the title suggests, the chapter has a section on each of the players. Rigid Islamization affected all areas of public life in Pakistan in the 80s, as General Zia-ul-Haq, H-A-Q, introduced draconian measures and punishments that he declared constituted the true implementation of Islamic law. By the time Zia was assassinated in 1988, 400,000 boys and young men known as Taliban or students were being educated in the Pakistani madrasas. Just skipping around here. And again, the long-standing policy of preference for Islamists over nationalists or Democrats. July 1977 coup by General Zia, then chief of the army, that overthrew Prime Minister Bhutto had in effect been welcomed by James Callaghan's Labour government. Then it mentions Musharraf's supposed commitment to the restoration of democracy after his military takeover in 1999. Thatcher, 1981, received a memo from Reagan conveying profound admiration for your forthright and courageous comments to the press in India on Pakistan's defense needs and on the situation in Afghanistan. Farther ahead, the second key terrorist organization in Pakistan developed out of the Markaz Dawah al-Irshad, the Center for Religious Learning and Welfare, or MDI, which was founded in 1987 by three Islamic scholars, including so-and-so, the Palestinian Muslim brother who organized the Mujahideen forces in the Afghan war, blah, blah, blah. The MDI appears to have received seed money from bin Laden. So, too, did its military wing. Interesting now, just acronym letter-wise, how this Pakistani organization called ISI, and now we've got, ISIS as another one. Islamic terrorist stuff, it just, the phrase Christian, something, that song, Christian Soldiers, it reminds me of that stuff. And farther down, again, he also argues that the intelligence agencies of the U.S. and the U.K. went along with Zia's policy of Arabizing, Wahhabizing the Muslims of Pakistan because this contributed to an increase in the flow of jihadist terrorists to Afghanistan. And farther on, at the end of this section, talking about when Salman Rushdie was called out for his books. The anti-Rushdie protests were supported by only a small minority of British Muslims, but sadly placed the broader British Muslim community under a harsh media spotlight. It took a long time for that community to recover. No sooner had it done so than first 9/11 and then the 7/7. I think that was London. 7/7 bombings dealt it even more severe blows. The radicalization of elements in the Muslim community in the 80s was already a case of blowback, given Britain's conniving with a Pakistani regime sponsoring Islamist and terrorist groups. And on to the King, following the Saudis. Forged after a humiliating British withdrawal from its colony of Aden in 1967, South Yemen was now a Marxist regime hosting Soviet military advisors and backing the Soviet-sponsored regime in Afghanistan. So here's the South Yemen versus the North Yemen. The Yemen campaign in the early 80s was organized by bin Laden, personally overseeing the activities of a group of Arab Afghans supported by millions of dollars of Saudi aid and Saudi white guards. Under King Fahd, Saudi Arabia pursued an openly pro-U.S. foreign policy in the 80s while continuing an oil policy to pressure other OPEC members to keep prices low. The Saudis helped finance a variety of Ronald Reagan's brutal covert wars, not only in Afghanistan, but also in Angola, Zaire, and Chad. While in Nicaragua, they helped bankroll U.S. support of the Contras, who were waging a brutal war against a popular elected government. King Fahd also paid $2 million to the CIA to help finance a secret operation to prevent the Communist Party from gaining power in Italy. The Saudis also continued funding whoever abroad might be useful to them, including Zia's Pakistan, Yasser Arafat's PLO, Saddam Hussein's Iraq during his conflict with Iran, now Saudi Arabia's arch rival, and the Islamic movement in the Philippines. And an interesting note, the Sunni Saudis now found themselves with a competitor for leadership of the Muslim world, revolutionary Shia Iran. Ah, Rodney King always comes to mind. Can we all get along? Later on, but as ever, economic interests prevailed, and by the early 80s, negotiations had resumed over British arms exports. Towards the end of this chapter, blah, 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 these deals meant that Britain was now even more beholden to the goodwill of the Saudi regime. In an 87 interview, Margaret Thatcher stressed the excellent relations between the two countries, the already minimal likelihood of Whitehall seriously distancing itself from the Saudis on any major issue now appeared to be ended. And cruising along here, the last section, a bit kind of a longer section, arming the Ayatollah. Well, both sets of Al-Yamama, that's the name of the group, A-L-Y-A-M-A-M-A-H. it's good to have some comic relief, and this book is so intense. While both sets of Al-Yamama arms negotiations were taking place with Saudi Arabia, Britain was covertly helping to arm the Saudis' main rival for supremacy in the Muslim world. This was revolutionary Iran, which was now vigorously instituting a brutal Shia theocracy under Ayatollah Khomeini. At the same time, in flagrant contravention of a UN embargo on supplying either side, Britain was also arming Saddam Hussein's Iraq, which had invaded Iran in 1980, September. The ensuing eight-year-long conflict would cost over 1 million lives. Let's see, later on, around the same time, Royal Ordnance, a government-owned company, exported 5 shipments of tetral chemicals, a compound used to make explosives and explosive powder, to Iran, in the process breaking both the UN embargo and Britain's own export guidelines. So there you have the criminal exporting of chemical, makings of chemical warfare, but of course we remember Colin Powell, before he owned up to it, waving his little anthrax vial. I think that was at the UN. And moreover, London was a major center through which Iran's multi-billion worldwide arms orders flowed. The Iranians used the offices of the National Iranian Oil Company as a front organization for their arms procurement effort. It acted as a base to buy the spare parts for their British-supplied tanks and to take advantage of London's banking and shipping facilities. It's like one-stop craziness. One stop. A radical empire ship shopping. What have you. And later on, as mention of these kidnappings were principally undertaken by groups with links to pro-Iranian Hezbollah, Party of God, organization which was established in Lebanon in 1982 when Iranian Revolutionary Guards were deployed to the Bekaa Valley following the Israeli invasion of Lebanon that year. So even, I mean, some of these groups, I haven't studied them all, but they may not do all, they might not do the nicest things, but sometimes they come out of, like, Hezbollah, formed after the Israeli invasion. So it's like sometimes these groups get, they get like a blacklisting bad name, which, again, may be partly true. I'm not trying to make a claim one way or the other, but I'm just saying that sometimes they are formed in response to. It puts a wider perspective and, takes it away from the good guy, bad guy thing, which is, what greases the military-industrial complex. And let's see, the U.S. and Britain had already taken to paying ransom for hostages during the 1979-81 U.S. Embassy hostage crisis in Iran, for example. The Carter administration had secretly released funds frozen in the U.S. at the outbreak of the Iranian Revolution, and most of the $3.5 billion in property held by the Shah in the U.S. Later on here, I'm not sure if this is the same thing. This is, I think, with Ali North and that whole Contra thing. One of the ironies of the British ransoms and arms-releasing efforts, Loftus and Ahrens point out, was that while the purpose was to influence Tehran as the assumed controllers of Hezbollah, it was actually the Syrian government that was paying the kidnappers' bills and controlled them unbeknown to the U.S. and British secret services. And there's mention of, I'm not sure if he just passed away, President Hashemi Rafsanjani. There was a guy mentioned, I think, Rafsanjani in the news recently. You can look that up if you want. And Britain would continue its involvement in arming Iran into the 1990s. According to former M16 officer Richard Tomlinson, in 1995, M16 became aware of a network involving the Israeli Secret Service that was organizing a Chinese shipment of 60 tons of chemicals to Iran in order to help Israel secure the release of its pilot, Ron Arad, A-R-A-D, taken prisoner in Lebanon years before. Rather than try to halt the project, M16 cooperated with it to gain intelligence on Iran's military network, even though it risked giving Tehran a chemical weapons capability. Oh, I made a note, entangled and reckless. It's just, I want to read that sentence again, because the amount of different players involved. Britain would continue, I'll just highlight the, Britain would continue its involvement in arming Iran, blah, 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 became aware of a Israeli secret service that was organizing a Chinese shipment to Iran to help Israel release a prisoner in Lebanon. Holy smokes. And later on, the CIA subcontracting the operation to Lebanese agents led by a former British SAS officer. The operation was funded by the Saudis to the tune of $3 million. All right, let's see. Getting to the last, read the last page or so of this chapter with my notes off, my note. Offshoots of Empire of Chaos. The 1980s witnessed the unprecedented growth of the radical Islamist movement, thanks principally to the Afghan War, the Islamization program of Pakistan's General Zia, Saudi funding to Islamist causes around the world, and Iranian sponsorship of a variety of Islamist groups, to all of which developments British policy had controlled in different ways. Gilles Kepel had noted that 1989 marks Islamism's peak of intensity as a political force. In that year, Algeria's radical Islamist party, the Islamic Salvation Front, was formed, becoming a fast-growing political force that soon captured half the votes in local and national elections, before a military coup prevented its taking political power. During the Palestinian uprising in the occupied territories, which had broken out in 1987, the hegemony of the secular PLO was for the first time challenged by new Islamist force, the Islamist Resistance Movement, or Hamas. Both the FIS and Hamas, among other Islamist movements, had a measure of popular support, having become the main political alternative to what were seen as failed secular nationalist movements. The year 1989 also saw the Soviet army evacuating its last troops from Afghanistan, defeated by the Afghan rebels and the foreign Mujahideen, while in Sudan, a Interesting. Russia has such a strong record. I wonder how they lost that one. But anyway, while in Sudan, a military coup catapulted the Islamist ideologue Hassan al-Turabi into power at the head of the National Islamic Front Party, which sought to impose an Islamic state under Sharia law. The new Sudanese regime had strong ties to the Muslim Brotherhood, and in August 89, 6 weeks after coming to power, al-Turabi attended a meeting of the International Muslim Brotherhood in London. At this meeting, al-Turabi, according to some sources, declared Sudan's willingness to act as a base from which Islamist terrorist groups could operate around the world. Within 3 years, Osama bin Laden had moved to Khartoum and established a new base for jihadist operations there. London was a fitting location for this meeting, since it was, even more than Khartoum, to become a and perhaps the global center for radical Islamist organizing in the following decade. And chapter 10 is going to bring to, it's called Nurturing Al-Qaeda, bringing into the 1990s. So thank you again for listening. It's just about halfway through this tangled, fascinating, and literally spy thriller of a book. So thanks for listening. Take care. Have a good one.